Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm as well. This is a Thursday edition. Hey, did you hear about the Cubs? Won the first World Series since 1908. It's been a while. Your brain on exercise. Turns out it's actually a pretty good thing. They're finding out more about that. And Starbucks is going to save the day. They've got the solution for some of the division we see in this country. Turns out you just need to make a new cup. We'll see if that works. That and a lot more stories coming your way on this Thursday edition, Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, online, kpcg.fm.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on 101.3 KPCG, kpcg.fm. That's where we are online. You can find a live link at thetrumpet.com. And we appreciate you being with us today here in Edmond, Oklahoma City, and all around the world. World Series last night. Grant Turgeon has a lot of insight about that, I'm sure. I'm Dwight Falk. This is the headline, Believe It. Cubs win first World Series since 1908 in epic Game 7, and it was epic, was it not? I found it to be epic.
It was probably the best game I've ever seen in terms of baseball. I mean, the stakes make it even more exciting. But back and forth, right when you think one team's dead, they come back. And then the team that should have been crushed by the other team's comeback rallied, and they still put the game away.
Yeah, and the rain delay there towards the end to build the drama. Mm-hmm. It really was one of those strange games where even though it was long, every pitch was like, hold your breath.
Yeah.
It's a really, really exciting game there. We were pretty excited watching at my house. I noticed my cat didn't care. He was sitting in the corner licking his paws. He was not interested at all in the action. So cats don't like baseball, I guess.
I'm going to make a prediction right now. That 17-minute rain delay is going to go down in the Cleveland sports history, along with the drive and the shot, as the most heartbreaking, devastating sports moments they've ever had, because they had all the momentum, and then as soon as you feel like the Cubs are about to collapse, they get a rain delay. The Cubs hold a players only meeting in their locker room, and then as soon as the rain delay is over, they score a couple runs and win the game.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it's the series captivated the attention of a lot of people in the U.S., and I got home last night, and I was planning to watch the game, but before that, took a walk around the block, get a little exercise, and it was really strange. It was like I was transported back in time. There were kids outside playing baseball, and I don't see that too often, in multiple houses. I don't know if it was because of the World Series or what, but just the sound of the ball hitting gloves and people hitting with the bat. I thought, where is this, like 1950 America? Like, where am I? So it was actually really nice. I like to see that. And then watching the game was kind of the same way. It was exciting. There's even a comment about the game. Somebody commented, said, finally, something our country can cheer about this depressing election year. And so it was really interesting to watch this game, be very excited, and then the political ads come on.
Right.
Oh, man. And you're transported back from, like, say, this Norman Rockwell sort of painting to the present day. Those are some of the worst ads I've ever seen. I mean, they were bad. And it was really a shock going from being excited and cheering about baseball. And then, do you know that if this man, you know, all the stuff that they would do, really a strange contrast for me.
Yeah, I was with a few friends and family members watching the game last night. And every time an ad would come on, I would confuse them by being like, "Yeah, Hillary Clinton." Like, what are you doing? Why are you so excited about this? I don't know. For me, the election stuff just never gets old. It's probably not the most dignified thing that you would want to see from a leader of a nation, but just the stuff just cracks me up. What they're saying about each other, and I mean, Hillary Clinton's ads especially, but I think both of them really do lack much substance. She just literally plays clips of things that he said insulting different people, which I think is going to have a bad impact of making everyone in the population oversensitive about everything.
Well, you know, it's again, it was just such a strange contrast between the two things, the game and these ads. And the one of the things that struck me about the ads, and it has this whole election season, is it didn't highlight anything positive about the person running.
No,
it was just
never.
how worse the other person was. And I know there's going to be a little bit of that, but what about saying, hey, you know, like projecting themselves positively and here's what I'm going to do and here's how I'll help you. Why not try it? It might be effective. But then again, maybe it's because there's really nothing to say positively other than to attack the other person. So I don't know. I think people are getting fed up with it.
True. And I think I have seen maybe a couple ads where they're more touting their own attributes instead of trashing the other person. But now they're going in for the kill. There's 5 days left, and they're pulling out all the stops, you could say.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens here on out. So it's interesting. Just looking at the headlines today, I was going through a couple of websites, and so I went to Drudge, and it was, you know, Cubs win, which seems like something out of a movie. And then it was a picture of Time magazine where Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are both holding this sign together. It says, "The end is near." End of the election, but maybe the end of something else too. And so all these weird headlines, and then the top one was about President Obama saying that, you know, the fate of the world is on the line, things like that. So I was like, wow, this is like a paper from the future, you know, of all these strange events happening that you see in like a movie from the 80s or something, and here we are reading these headlines.
Yeah, I mean, no one ever thought the Cubs would win it, and I will say, though, they were the big-time favorites all year long. It wasn't like this was some kind of underdog story this year specifically, but whenever you consider that they haven't won since 1908, that's a long drought. A lot of teams have been lucky. They've stumbled into championships several times over that amount of time. So the Cubs finally pulled it off, and then that's what people say, that the end of the world is near when the Cubs win the World Series. It's happened.
It's happening. Yeah, and it's interesting, too, just with some of the like the political headlines and the ads and that type of thing. And we've talked about this before, but one person has to win. And how are people going to become unified after that fact? Because, you know, each side is accusing the other, sometimes rightfully, sometimes wrongfully, of the worst things. But somebody's got to win. And if you come out and say, well, if this person wins, it's like the end of the world. Well, what happens if they do win? Mm-hmm. You say, well, I was just kidding about that. Carry on. I mean, some pretty strong things are being said, and it's going to be hard for people to come together after the fact.
Yeah, well, you know, things like Trump is literally Hitler and then Hillary Satan. Whenever that is what you think of the other side, as soon as a person like that takes charge, that's how you're going to think of the leader of your country, and there are going to be millions of other people who feel the same way. And it's never been that extreme before. I don't think back in the early days of the country they were calling Thomas Jefferson, you know, Thomas Satan or anything like that.
Maybe a little more dignity back then. I don't know. But, well, in any event, in trying to unify the country, Starbucks is doing their part. They're rolling out the Unity Cup ahead of Election Day. So if you like to spend whatever it is, $15 for a coffee these days, that might be an exaggeration.
What is it, barely, like an elephant and a donkey hugging?
No, it's it's a green cup. You can see pictures of it online. It features a mosaic of more than 100 people, including a coffee farmer and barista. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz calls it, quote, a divisive time in our country, and says in a statement that the coffee giant wanted to come up with a symbol to serve as a reminder of our shared values. I'm not sure what those are anymore, actually. The cup debuts on Tuesday, the same day Seattle-based Starbucks brings back its traditional holiday drinks with the red cups that everyone was mad about, I guess. People said they weren't festive enough. So no one's happy with the cups, but, you know, you can't fault somebody for trying to do something, I guess, that they think is going to work. But with all the deep, deep divisions, it's like, well, what about this cup, guys? Think it's not going to work.
Just keep on selling coffee. Yep. That's probably the most safe route.
Our common values is that we're willing to spend a lot of money on Starbucks. That's what he meant.
It's what do they call that? The edible oil or something like that, where it's such a lucrative business, and then we spend way more money on that than we would even gassing up the car.
Yeah, it is. It is amazing how much that stuff costs. So anyway, they're going to roll out their cup and see if there's any unity there because of that. We've been talking lately about how the TV networks are way down in their viewership. There is a report here. It's from the Hollywood Reporter. A study that's out. Almost half of Americans say they can't find something good to watch on TV. What about the other half? What are they watching? The World Series, maybe.
They're more settled in their preferences.
Maybe they just gave up. It says between 2010 and 2016, mobile viewing has surged 85%, while viewing on fixed-screen TVs has declined 14%, according to a new study. So the way people are watching things has changed. But this is interesting. It says the average person spends 23 minutes per day trying to find something good to watch on broadcast TV. That turns out to be 1.3 years of their lives changing channels. Oh. You know, so next time somebody's like, well, I can't find any time, I'd be like, I bet I know where 23 minutes could go. You could find 23 minutes.
That's really extreme. I would not expect that. I mean, the thing is, every ad I see is about some horror TV series or zombies or some show that has all these disgusting immoral values in it. So it is kind of hard if you're looking for a TV show to get into right now. But I mean, if you like sports, that's always there.
Yeah, and that has been the big cash cow, especially the NFL. But now those numbers are down, so everyone's kind of getting nervous. What are people going to watch? I don't know. Read a book, maybe.
Exactly.
No, couldn't
Great
come
books.
To that. But so that's a lot of time. I don't watch much TV these days. I did more when I was younger. But I, you know, if I'm ever, say, traveling and you're in a hotel or something and you've got like a million channels at the hotel, I do nothing but change the channel. Just because I don't know what's on the next one. I can't sit still. I just got to keep flipping through them. I couldn't rest on one knowing maybe I'm missing something on the other ones.
Well, yeah, I think that's a more contented version of changing the channels, where you just want to see every channel and what it has. So that's kind of actually enjoyable, I think, because I don't have a TV either. So when I finally have access to all those channels, I'm doing the exact same thing you are.
And I think a good indication of a person getting old is when they're just fine to watch the Weather Channel for hours on end. It's the same weather. It's not changing. It's the same thing, but we just keep on watching this.
There are only so many options.
Really? Yeah, that's true. So I just was surprised by that number, 23 minutes per day trying to find something to go to watch on TV. And then how many hours do they spend watching it, you know? But they say a lot of people, of course, are looking at YouTube or other services, and a lot of people are watching him on their phones. And that's the biggest thing for millennials now is, if I can watch it on my phone, then I'll, you know, I may watch it. But if they can't watch it on their phone, a lot of times they're just not interested. So the way people are viewing things are changing.
Yeah, online exclusive TV or shows are really increasing now, where they'll put out a show, but it's only on the Amazon Prime Video or Netflix or Hulu or whatever else, and it never sees the TV screen at all. That's probably what the TV stations are most worried about.
Well, I think it's such a lower overhead for those companies to make a show and then just put it up there, as opposed to spending all this money making a movie for the theaters and then people don't go to watch it. It's hard to break even on those. And even movie watching is down a fair bit at the theaters. So I guess it's probably partly convenience. It's partly the expense of it. If you go to a movie and you're taking your family or something, be prepared to spend $60, $70. Mm-hmm. You know, and you walk out of there thinking, wow, why did we do that? So there's just not a lot of good shows out these days. But and it's interesting, too, if you ever watch some older movies that are actually pretty good, there's not, you know, it doesn't have all the wild effects and all this stuff. It's just actually a pretty good story. Mm-hmm. And I found myself watching one or two of those in the last few months. And I was like, that was a really good story. I was really interested. But there was no big action or it was just some people talking about something I was interested in.
Yeah, my wife and I actually had to go and resort to a children's animated movie recently, because we've just been seeing so many movies where, like, there are parts where you just really cringe at it because you feel uncomfortable being in the same room as someone else and seeing what's on the screen. But we saw one about Robinson Crusoe before he was rescued, apparently, and he was having to fight off these vicious cats that were trying to hurt all of his animal friends. So that was actually refreshing, though, for once, to see a movie that I knew for a fact would not have a bunch of disgusting parts. And also, it didn't have any liberal agenda in it either, which was somewhat surprising, at least.
Yeah, you know what's really surprising is if I go to a movie these days, it's to take the kids, right? And it doesn't happen too often, but I'll go occasionally. And some of the previews in before kids' movies, you just are so upset. You think, well, who's responsible for this? You know this is a kids' movie. And yet you're showing stuff that's just outrageous.
Right.
And so you got to do the old, like, close your eyes, shut your ears, don't look at this. I even do that because I don't want to see the stuff. And it's before a kids' movie. That really bothers me.
There's a really small difference between what previews you're allowed to show before an R-rated movie and before any other movie. I think they allow curse words in previews before an R-rated movie, but they don't before any other movie. But really, the content could be the same. They would just take out the curse words for any movie rated under R, and you could still see the same horrifying, demonic content on the screen.
Yeah. They should just give everyone a remote there, and we'd just all turn the channel. Just kind of, everybody keeps changing every 2 seconds.
Fighting.
Yeah.
Fighting for ultimate control.
The giant remote. people have always known, I think, over the years that if you exercise, it's good for you, within moderation. They're finding out more about the way exercise affects your brain. This is from the Huffington Post. Exercise changed this neuroscientist's life, and now she wants to change yours. This lady is 51 years old. She was devoted to solving intricate physiological questions about the brain for almost her entire adult life. Her name is Wendy Suzuki. Drives a Honda. I don't know what she drives. I just wanted to make that joke. She is a neuroscientist at New York University and was proud of all the work she'd done, put a lot of work into it. It says, but the long hours dedicated to research eventually left her feeling socially isolated and physically weak. So she took up the habit of going to the gym on a regular basis and found that, her life improved. She really liked it. So she said, you know what? I want to figure out how exercise affects the brain. And so she had been spending her whole career, made a name for herself in this other field, and now she changed to this. And she says, it was a hard decision to make, but once I made the decision, I knew it was the right one. And so she's found some interesting results, things that I think we kind of know, but probably don't know exactly how it works. Not that she knows exactly how it works, but they can see some benefits to the exercise. It says, many people have noticed firsthand, exercising makes the mind sharper and attention more focused. And that's because another brain area heavily affected by aerobic exercise is the prefrontal cortex, an area in charge of high-level functioning, including executive functions, decision-making, and attention. They think it may also delay Alzheimer's for people. They don't know that it'll prevent it, but they say it can delay it at least for several years. And so there's several exercises that are particularly good for certain things. They say if you want to improve your mood, taking a walk is a good way to do it. Aerobic exercise and high-intensity interval training can improve your mood as well, all of those things. And so I think we've all probably done that a time or two where something's bothering us and we just take a walk, and you feel better.
Definitely. Yeah, a couple mornings ago when we got back into playing basketball here on the campus gym for the first time in a couple weeks, we played, and I was exhausted afterward. But for some reason, as I was getting ready for work, I just had this flood of positive thoughts. And I couldn't figure out why for a little bit, but then I thought it must have been because of the exercise, because I hadn't really been moving around a whole lot in the previous 2 weeks. And all of a sudden, these positive thoughts just come out of nowhere. Normally, there's like a little bit of stress, a little bit of a weight of responsibility, but that morning, I just felt like I could fly pretty much.
Yeah. Well, it's because you're making your jump shot. That's why. But
not really.
but no, that I think we've all experienced that. You do feel just much better after a nice exercise. They say it also can help your memory. The best evidence for, they have a technical term for it. We'll just call it memory because that's what we know it as. It's continuous aerobic exercise. So if you have a little bit of a longer exercise, kind of like playing a basketball game, that can help your memory as well. And so they've found proof of that. And it also can help your attention. Aerobic exercise is, again, the best option if you want to boost attention. But unlike with memory, the improvements are more acute and come faster. So some things you can notice right away, other things are more long-term. Jogging, biking, treadmill, etc., all good options for getting a boost in your attention. So sometimes that happens. You see somebody that's kind of groggy or tired, and or a kid or yourself, and you say, well, let's get up and get some exercise. And then you can come back and focus better again. And the brain works that way, I guess.
It really does. My father has a class that he teaches, and usually about halfway through, he sees people pretty tired, and so he has everyone get up and do jumping jacks, or he'll have a student lead the class in stretches, and then you can just tell there's a visible difference among all the students, he says.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so that's a good way to get going. And they've said that, too, even about, you know, energy. If you feel like you're just tired, now granted, you do have to sleep at some point, but if it's kind of middle of the day and you're tired, getting up and moving around helps. So this is all kind of things, I think, that we sort of know anyway just by experience, but they're finding out that it's connected. But again, they are very much just in the beginning stages of trying to figure out how this machine works, the brain and the body and all of that. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, of course we know in general that exercise is healthy, but to know specifically how we can formulate a strategy and really get on a plan that helps us the most, that is extremely helpful information. I know someone who every time he's tired does push-ups, which seems like a great idea because that adds up, and then you start building muscles and overcoming any drowsiness you might have.
Yep, and then your arms are bigger. You can rest your head on them like pillows.
That's right.
There's all kinds of benefits. So kind of interesting story there. Of course, this is happening here, Grant, this next story. Universities, we were talking about some of the college things that go on in the United States in particular, and some puzzling things. This is from Forbes magazine. A public university makes students choose between their First Amendment rights and graduation. If you say the wrong thing, you're not going to graduate. If you can believe that, can you believe? Of course we can believe that.
Of course this is happening. Yeah, we're just trying to muzzle everybody's free speech under the guise, again, of tolerance and acceptance and really some pseudo form of love for other people.
Yeah, this particular case is at Iowa State University. ISU students are told that they must abide by the school's policy against harassment. That's a pretty general term. Harassment of anyone in the university community. Students must complete a training program consisting of 118 online slides. So just even think about that. Here you have to go through this training process of all the ways that you can't offend people, and there's 118 slides that you have to follow. Wouldn't it be easier just to pay attention to the Ten Commandments? There's only 10 of them.
Or to just walk around with your mouth duct tape just to avoid any mistakes.
I guess. So they've got to look at these 118 slides online. It covers the university's non-harassment policies and procedures. And then they have to pledge never, never to violate them. How can you pledge to never violate almost anything? Humans are not good at that. I will never eat another donut, I pledge this day. I mean, whoever would actually abide by something like that?
Hopefully no one makes the pledge. It's just too easy to slip up, especially in maybe a moment of anger. You're frustrated with someone, and then all of a sudden you've broken your pledge.
But the thing is, if you don't pledge, they're coming for you. That's the thing. Oof. It says, but what if a student thinks that the ISU policy goes way beyond preventing true harassment and amounts to an abridgment of his rights under the First Amendment? In that case, ISU reserves the right to withhold the student's degree. Wow. So either the student agrees to abide by the policy, even though it may well keep him from speaking out as he'd like to, or have his academic work go for naught. This is the exact dilemma an ISU student, one Robert Dunn, finds himself in. So this is happening to a young Robert.
Wow. Probably a conservative student, once again, being persecuted for just having a belief that's out of the mainstream.
It says he regarded the ISU strict... I don't know what they mean.
Stricture?
Strictures. Yeah, that's a weird word.
Yeah.
Strictures against harassment to be so sweeping and vague that he couldn't pledge never to say anything that might violate them. And that's the honest truth. Mm. How could you ever pledge to never, ever offend anyone? That's impossible. It's an impossibility, right?
It's like they're making you study a detailed law book to become a legal scholar, and you have to know it inside and out to even be able to follow it.
So he didn't agree with this, and a student can be guilty of harassment just because someone else doesn't think what he said has a constructive purpose, is unacceptable, or wasn't really necessary. They can withhold your degree because you said something that wasn't necessary.
I can think of so many things that people say that aren't necessary just in my everyday interactions.
Wouldn't that be most of the classes at ISU? Is this really necessary?
What about that class about the Beyonce album? Is that a necessary class?
Well, that one is, but yeah. So just unbelievable. It's like we're living in a dream world or something. Agreeing to that policy would mean agreeing to stifle your thoughts on a vast array of controversial topics. Given the extreme sensitivity of many students these days and their eagerness to claim victim status, speaking your mind could readily land you in trouble with the campus speech police. Campus speech police? This is an actual story. Forbes magazine.
Just a bunch of precious cupcakes just growing up, not realizing that anyone can have an opposing viewpoint without it being a crime. Those are the type of young people that are coming up through these institutions.
I just have this vision of like these students, you know, and one of them saying something that wasn't deemed necessary, and the other one crying out, "But you took the pledge. You promised.
How could you? How could you break the pledge?
You promised to never say anything unnecessary. We trusted you." I can't even believe this is actually happening.
I could imagine all the extremes of how they might punish the student as well. Just some sort of crazy ritual.
Did you look at the slides? Did you look at all those slides? I can't. 118 slides. You know how it is. Most students are just going to flip through them all and go, yeah. You know, hit the pledge and move on because they got to get to the, you know, whatever they're going to do that day. But, boy. Yeah, you just have to be careful. You wouldn't want to offend anybody, which means basically just show up, never say anything, and go on your way, I guess.
That story brought tears to our eyes, and it was, I think we were both sorrowful, but just we're just cracking up at the same time that this is even happening.
And what are they going to do when they go out to the work world, you know? they have to take the pledge with them and make the company pledge, make everyone pledge.
You got a 60-year-old man there who just won't tolerate their rules.
Well, you know, and how far are we going to go with this? We could do it on a species basis as well, where we could have the you know, you don't want to be offended by your cat or offend your cat or whatever. All kinds of possibilities that could happen. So unbelievable. Just more and more of that stuff. So we actually had, there was another story I was going to talk about in this segment, but Grant's got it for later, and it's a good one too.
We're of one mind. It could easily fit in this part.
There's so many stories that are just unbelievable that are out there. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm. And you can email us, too. Comments, questions, concerns, anything, you can send those to comments@kpcg.fm. We'd like to take a look at those, even story ideas as well. Oh, by the way, that reminds me. I'm Dwight Falk, by the way. Grant Turgeon's here, and Abraham Blondo is stopping by, too.
Yes.
Yeah, so we've got the three-headed monster here. it reminds me, I was thinking about the emails there. I got an email from a listener yesterday saying that there is a quote, I think it was from Mike Huckabee, where he said that there was a survey that said, I think it was something like 12% of people believe that Hillary Clinton tells the truth, but 14% of people believe Bigfoot's real. So you got to look at the numbers.
I love Mike Huckabee. He gave one of the most blunt interviews I've ever seen from him with Megyn Kelly recently about just, I guess he was basically defending Donald Trump, but he's really starting to speak his mind now, and so is Ben Carson. There's a couple of guys who are just kind of tired of all of the media bias, I think.
Yeah, for sure. So anyways, if you send those comments, we appreciate those. It adds a little spice to the program.
I think it's time for Bigfoot to come and clear his mind, be a little more outspoken. So
he took the pledge not to offend any of the humans because he attended Iowa State.
Wasn't there a Bigfoot hunt on a college campus recently?
There was.
Like sanctioned by the leader of the university?
Yeah.
I just don't understand how that could happen.
You know, you think Bigfoot would be easy to find because he'd have to walk in circles? Because he's one Bigfoot and one Littlefoot. He'd have to walk around. His name is Bigfoot, not Big Feet. So he'd just be walking around circles.
It would throw off his gait.
That sounds like a Canadian legend that your parents told you when you were a kid. I always assumed it was the 2 feet, but
it's like toothbrush though. That's for multiple teeth. So
that's true.
We just don't call it a toothbrush.
The English language fails me again.
Oh, very interesting. As a reminder, the Key of David program is coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host today, Brad McDonald from Edstone, England, talking about some archaeology and how that ties into the Bible. Very interesting program. Make sure you listen for that. And if you can't catch it live, you can always get the archives at kpcg.fm. Abe, you got an interesting story for us. Before we get into that, though, there was actually kind of two stories to talk about today, but the first one we won't get into as much. But it's kind of breaking news, I guess. Court ruling throws Brexit process into doubt. It says Britain's plans to leave the European Union were thrown into confusion Thursday after a court ruled that members of Parliament must be given a say in the process. There's some technicality to this that somebody like myself, who's not familiar with all the laws, it seems a little odd, but maybe you can explain that real quick.
Sure. Yeah, it's it does add an extra layer of complexity to Brexit. So when the referendum was in favor of leave, the British government had to trigger Article 50 of their agreement with the European Union of the Lisbon Treaty to allow them to exit. And that was the accepted path. Theresa May, the Prime Minister, said that by May of 2017, they were going to do so.
Okay, and then that's like a two-year process, right? So like 2019 would be the official we're done, from what
right.
I saw. Okay.
Yeah, that's when they would be completely out of the EU.
Right.
But with this development, the British Supreme Court said that that's actually unconstitutional and that Parliament has to vote on whether Theresa May can actually leave a treaty, if she can leave, trigger Article 50. So, in other words, the referendum might not be. It depends on what the Parliament says. The UK government is going to appeal it, and they're going to look at it again. But even if the Parliament will probably vote for Brexit anyway, because I think, for what I understand of Parliament's makeup, most of them are leave at the current time. But still, no one really knows how it could swing the vote. So this is conceivable that in the end, they could actually stay in the EU.
As if the EU would keep them, right?
Right, exactly.
And that's the thing. It's just more like red tape, I guess. And then I don't think the Europe wants them.
Yeah, the Attorney General actually called that an attempt to surpass the democratic will of the people. And it just kind of shows you that all these people going to vote, it's really just a facade if it comes down to a few members of Parliament. And even here, obviously, we have the Electoral College. We just don't have a real system where the people actually choose. We're just kind of made to believe that we're in charge.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's my belief that Parliament will vote for to leave, because if the constituents believe in leave, then since they represent the constituents, they do have to vote for, especially if there's a lot of pressure from their riding or constituency in Britain. So I do expect them still to leave, but it just might push the timetable, just makes things complicated. And I think the biggest outcome of all this is that Europe will just get even more frustrated, and they might just say, like, it doesn't matter what your Parliament says, you're out of this anyway.
Right.
Because it's just adding more uncertainty, and it just makes Europe's job so much harder with everything that's already going on.
Well, and the vote was such an affront to the EU that I don't think they'd want them back anyway. Say, well, you didn't want to be here, so get lost.
Exactly.
So it'd be interesting to see, but it's just more complications. This other story here you have is from Project Syndicate. This is from Joschka Fischer, I believe, wrote this. He was the German foreign minister and vice chancellor from 1999 to 2005. And I like his name. the title is How Much Europe Do Europeans Need? So he's kind of breaking into this topic of European unity. And they're going to have to reshift somewhat, it looks like. And so what does he have to say?
Yeah, this is a really interesting piece, because obviously Joschka Fischer, he's a lot of experience, and he is a very influential voice in Europe. And he makes an interesting point here. And basically, in his article, he's making the case for unity, for closer unification in Europe. And he says that nation states are out of date, that nation states aren't the answer to Europe's problems. So in other words, European nations shouldn't be turning inward to fix economics, the migrant crisis, all these different things. But rather, in order to solve those problems, they need to unify.
Yeah.
And
what's interesting, too, I think you guys probably saw that video of in Paris. Did you see that, where the immigrants are fighting each other?
Yeah.
It looked like something out of some crazy movie.
Yeah, it looked like Capcom.
I'm not familiar with the reference.
It's a fighting video game.
Okay. Well,
Tekken?
Is that, yes. Yeah.
Is that another one?
Yeah. Street Fighter?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, it just looks like something surreal, but that's happening in like these major European cities.
Yeah, and that stuff, you know, if you're just a regular old resident, you got to be like, come on, are we going to let this go on? You can't let that go on, so something's got to happen.
Yeah, and that's what he says here. He says that with all these different crises going on, that he thinks a lot of Europeans are blaming or saying that democratic institutions are failing them, and they need to look to the good old days to find a solution.
Which would be what? What are the good old days?
Well, exactly. But that's the problem with this article. I think he actually has a logical fallacy in it, because he blames nationalism for the two world wars, the Holocaust, basically all these problems. And that's true to an extent, but he doesn't say whose nationalism
right.
was at fault. And that was Germany's nationalism.
Right.
Every other state's nationalism hasn't been an existential threat to the world. Yeah. Just one nation's.
Right, because if you look at some of that history, there were a lot of surrounding nations that were kind of on the fence. They weren't sure who they were going to go with. I think they were trying to hedge their bets about who's going to win, right? But a lot of nations, even a lot of the nations, wouldn't give up their Jews to the Germans. They would hide them, or they wouldn't let them come over for a while. And so to make it out like all these nations were in, they were just kind of watching it happen.
Yeah, that's what is a little puzzling about this. And he says he's talking about all the different nationalist movements like Brexit, the one in France with Marine Le Pen. And he asked the question, how could it have come to this? Given Europe's firsthand experience with nationalism's destructive power in the 20th century, when it caused millions of deaths and devastated the entire continent. Now, that's not true. Because, I mean, Germany's nationalism did that to the rest of Europe. British nationalism has never done that. French nationalism has never done that. And so he says, let's get past nationalism and unify as one continent. And he's like, that's... So
the problem, which is the German nationalism, can just control the entire continent.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and it's he has another statement here. He said, it is absurd to think that Europe's historic nation states are an answer to the globalized political, economic, and technological realities of the 21st century. If Europeans believe that, they must be willing to pay the price for less integration in the form of declining prospects and new dependencies. And then he just says basically that Europe's going to pay and China and Russia will get the best of them. But that's the thing he isn't talking about is that European unification isn't a new thing. It's actually older than the nation state. And so these nations are looking back to the good old days of when Europe did try to unify itself. And that's exactly what he's pointing to, is that European unification is older than the nation state, and that's actually the most violent times in European history. It wasn't German nationalism in the 20th century, certainly did. But let's think about the most violent times in European history. Charlemagne, Charles V, Napoleon, Hitler, and all those were forms of the Holy Roman Empire, which was European unification. So that's why it's a logical fallacy, is because all the attempts at European integration led to huge world conflicts that millions of people died. And so it's just a little puzzling argument here, but he is saying, like, get over yourselves, me unified, to stop this from happening. When actually that's going to lead to the very thing they think they're going to prevent.
Yeah. He's happy for people to get over themselves and unify as long as he can be the boss.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
That's like playing a basketball game, you know, and you're the guy that wants to tell everybody what to do. And so you're like, would you guys quit being so selfish and listen to what I'm telling you here?
It's almost like this writer hopes that people won't look too deep into the history to find out how that has turned out in the past. And I guess the idea of uniting as a continent seems like the only way to counteract a nation like Russia right now. And so he's in favor of that, but he has to try to reconcile that with obviously the violent past that idea has.
Right. And that's probably, I was thinking the same thing. If you're not really thinking about the history of it, yeah, maybe it seems like a solution for now. And that's probably where a lot of people are sitting, whether in Europe, the United States, anywhere. I'm not so interested about the past. What about me right now? I mean, Hitler talked about that, right? Because that's one of the things that got him in power was that their economy was suffering. He promised like a chicken in every pot or whatever the thing was. So times have changed somewhat. But, you know, it's still the same basic. I don't really, you know, people could think, I don't really care about this big world vision. I just want to make sure I've got food to eat today. I got a job and I got a roof over my house and you guys can hash out the rest of it. But if people aren't looking back and seeing the, where it's been in the past, then it's easy to not see where it's going right now.
Yeah, that's the problem is when times are bad, people put on rose-colored glasses when they look at times in the past when their nation was maybe stronger. That's why a lot of Russians admire Stalin. When Stalin killed more Russians himself than the Germans did, I believe.
Stalin, interesting little thing about him, you know, his son was taken captive by the Germans in World War II, and they put him in a concentration camp, and where they were dying, they were starving to death and everything else. And Germany offered him back for a swap, and Stalin said, "Nah." Now they didn't get along; they didn't have a great history together. But what kind of a man is that?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean that's true with Europe too, where especially here, I think Fisher tries to paint the 20th century. World War One, especially Hitler and World War Two, that was blamed on nationalism, and that's worse than anything that happened before in Europe. So it has to be better than the 20th century. When that's not necessarily the case, and Hitler did call on that old European heritage of like the crown jewels of the Holy Roman Empire when he was in power, and that's the heritage that he's talking about here. And so, but he is right to the extent where people they're looking for a solution. And they're seeing that democracy isn't working. They do want the good old days. And without saying it, that's exactly what he's proposing as a solution. That a federalized Europe will not be a democracy. The EU is not a democratic institution the way it is right now. It's led by unelected officials. And that's if it gets closer in union, that it's just going to be more of the same.
You know, he very well may have sort of inadvertently been very honest here. Maybe that is what he thinks are the good old days.
Right.
You know, we're in charge, we call the shots, and everybody get out of our way.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the thing. In Europe, it's difficult because it is so fractured in all these different languages, cultures, religions, that either you have to tolerate everyone else and not have expansionist plans, or someone has to lead and dominate everyone else. Those are the two options, and that we in the 20th century we did try that, but Germany, they wouldn't accept other nations' sovereignty. They always wanted to expand, and so that's basically what he's saying here. In a way, it's like your sovereignty doesn't matter, your culture doesn't matter. We need to unify to defeat our common enemies, and while they do need to help to counteract their enemies, it doesn't mean that a nation's culture and traditions can be trampled underfoot just for the sake of expediency.
We have some really good write-ups, some good books and booklets at thetrumba.com about what you can expect to see with Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, Europe, etc. There's a lot there, so make sure you go back and read those. Pretty interesting, Abe. We'll have you hang around here and because you're going to enjoy this next story. moving from Europe to the crazy old United States of America. You guys remember, of course, Rachel Dolezal? She's the lady that is white, but she identifies as black.
Yes, the curly white hair or curly black or brown hair.
She brought to light the new concept of racial identification, I guess. Transit racial transition, whatever it is.
Yeah. Transracialism, something like that.
Transracialism. and so she's back with a vengeance. She's got a new book out. I think it's called In Full Color. Is that correct? It's not a joke. Ed Grant's got some more information about what you can expect if you happen to get this book for your coffee table.
This does have to be one of the funniest stories I've ever read, but she apparently a couple days ago announced that she has a new book titled In Full Color, Finding My Place in a Black and White World. So you can tell right there just by the subtitle that she is a race hustler.
Well, there's more than just two races.
Exactly.
It's not just the black and white world.
She's pitting the races as polar opposite enemies, basically. And it's just a pretty inflammatory thing to do, especially the way things are today But apparently the book talks about her early days as a young white child with white evangelical parents. But she also did have four black adopted siblings. So maybe that's kind of why she started to identify that way. And then into adulthood, she transformed into the black woman she is today. It says here.
Sort of.
Yeah, she's got a spray tan, basically. It talks about how she had a sense of belonging in some of the black communities where she lived in Jackson, Mississippi, and Washington, D.C. She felt more at home, basically, among the blacks than she did among the whites. And then she talks about the discrimination she suffered while living as a black woman.
Right.
If you can imagine, and probably the extent of the discrimination is her own parents outing her as an actual white person, or the people who found out she was a liar also telling her that she's a liar for thinking she's black.
Yeah, when this story happened, it was almost like unbelievable. And then she tried to stand up for herself and say, and now, of course, saying that she's being discriminated against. It's okay to be white and also like other races and get along with them. That's a really good thing. You don't have to pretend to be that race.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that's most confusing about this is race is science. Race, what race you are is a matter of science.
Yeah.
It's a matter of what your blood type, how much of a certain pigment you have in your skin, that's what makes your colors appear the way it is. It has nothing to do with what you choose in your own mind.
Oh, but the book summary would disagree with that.
You haven't read the book, Abraham. Reserve your judgments, please.
The summary says, her story is nuanced and complex, and in the process of telling it, she forces us to consider race in an entirely new light, not as a biological imperative, but as a function of the experiences we have, the culture we embrace, and ultimately the identity we choose.
It's just like being raised by wolves.
It's like, I am a wolf now.
Now you're a wolf.
Yeah. That is a great movie. But it's
Dances
like,
with Wolves. Yeah. It's not Raids by Wolves, or is that a different movie?
No, it is Dancing with Wolves.
Okay. Right.
That should be the name of my autobiography, all right. But maybe she should have called her book Technicolor or something like that, because that seems more accurate. But it is just amazing just how people are going to buy it, read it, and believe it.
Well, I don't know about that. They may very well buy it. I can't, other than just, I don't know who would even bother with something like this. I imagine there might be a college course on it at some point.
Right.
But like you say, and that's the point, Abraham, it's science. You can't. But again, that's the world we're living in today, where people are just closing their eyes like tiny children and ignoring the reality of their race, their gender, and saying, well, nah, I'm going to pretend to be something else. Well, pretend time's over. You're not two anymore. I mean, you got to move on. All kids pretend to be something.
Well, this thing about Bigfoot, he doesn't have a choice. That's his name because he has big feet. So I'm being facetious, of course. But that's the point, is that race and these ways we identify, it's fine. Like you said, it's fine to live in a community with people who aren't the same skin color and be fine. Be friends with them, be family with them in a sense. That's fine. That's perfectly okay. That's actually good. That's a very good thing that you can get along with everyone, doesn't matter, regardless of your race. But the fact that she's actually making things worse by picking a side, and instead of just saying, it doesn't matter what race you are, you can coexist or live with each other, instead now she's forcing you to pick a side. You have to identify as one or the other.
Well, and what's happening really is, and we see this happen a lot, is she got caught lying to a lot of people and making money off of it. And then what do you do? Well, come out and say you've been victimized in some way, and you know, you've got this new thing that other people don't understand. When the truth is, well, you just got caught lying.
And it works every time. When these people lie and get caught and they claim victimhood, it works every time. I mean, these people just automatically are sympathized with, and we have to really try to dig deep and find some compassion for people who are white but think they're black somehow. There are, as you might expect, plenty of detractors to the idea of her having a book. People on Twitter, this person wrote, if the first line of Rachel Dolezal's book isn't "I'm white, then I'm not interested." Another one said, which white actress in blackface will play Rachel Dolezal in the Lifetime movie based on her hack book about her lie of a life? So yeah, that's a pretty in-depth tweet there.
Yeah, it's not, you know, and the thing is, if you want to talk about color, well, it's all about green. She's trying to make money. It doesn't have anything to do with anything else.
She's a con artist. She's been outed as a con artist, and yet we're supposed to be tolerant of that somehow.
Yeah, it's really interesting. But, you know, it also highlights just the reality that once you get away from basic law, which is scientific for the most part, right, and man starts just going his own way and he wants to do things his own way, it gets more and more confused and more tangled. And it just becomes so bizarre. I mean, I don't think anyone will accept on any level what she's saying because it goes against all the narratives that are out there, even the idea of racism being a big issue. Well, if you can choose your race by how you identify yourself, well, then that completely gets rid of that, right? So there's no leg to stand on there for that argument. So I don't think she's going to find a lot of takers for her position.
Yeah, I think, too, a lot of people find it insulting, especially those who are serious about human rights advocacy and that whatnot, because it does make a mockery of everything that's happened in this country, all the good things that have happened, because, I mean, the Constitution and the freedoms in this country are set up that we're all equal regardless of race, and that people, a lot of people have even died and fought hard to bring a lot of good change, the things that did need to be changed. But now those same laws and arguments are being used for people who have been caught lying and just trying to exploit the system and just make a mockery of all these great freedoms that are really centerpieces of American way of life.
Well, right. And, you know, I personally, and I think most people, I don't care what somebody pretends as long as they just mind their own business. She can pretend to be whatever she wants. She can pretend to be an elephant. I don't care. Just don't come over to my house and say, you know, I'm an elephant, you must give me peanuts or whatever. then it's infringing upon, you know, people think all kinds of things. But the fact that she's pushing it on everyone like it's everybody else's problem that she lied and now she wants to make money off of a book, that's where all that stuff gets, well, it's all crazy anyway. But when you take your own personal craziness and try to push it on everybody else, now you're infringing upon everybody else.
And if I remember correctly, this is the same woman who invented this story about how there was a noose placed in her belongings or on her front doorstep or something like that. And that's really a despicable lie. And to just keep bringing up race as if it's such a huge issue now. We fought 50, 60 years ago for civil rights to completely abolish segregation. 100 years before that, we fought to in a very bloody civil war to abolish slavery, although that was not the primary reason for the war, but that was the outcome. And yet we're trying to pretend like everyone today is still so racist. It is really beyond comprehension at this point when, like you even said, we can choose our race, we can choose our gender. If everything is blurred like that, why can't we all get along better than that?
Right. Yeah, you would think so, right? Wouldn't everybody get along? But it gets more and more divisive. That's a real shame that there's even a book being made like this, but it's out there. I think at the end of the day, she was just she was doing it because she was making some money. You know, she had a position, NAACP chapter president. I don't know how much that pays or whatever, but that was her job, was her identity. And she's keeping this secret that she's not actually who she says she is. And then gets caught and then, you know, makes this whole other thing. I mean, she even went on TV, I remember, and tried to defend what she was saying. And it's just embarrassing.
Well, all I'm going to say is there better not be any black and white pictures in that book. If it's called In Full Color, there better be
full.
full color pictures in that book.
And a poster pullout.
Yeah, that's right.
And trading cards.
Yeah.
And bubblegum. Everything that you need for this book. So, well, it'll be interesting to see if that sells. I mean, maybe somebody will buy. Yeah, you know, we like to go to bookstores. I think all of us do. And so keep your eye out on the bargain. If it's a dollar, I got to tell you, I might be tempted. If I see it at half price books for a buck, I might buy it.
I would buy it at full price just for a good laugh, honestly. And there's a horde of social justice warriors who would buy it because they believe some of the principles involved.
It's going to be interesting to see what they're thinking about. But it's just getting more and more confusing. And it's just unbelievable that that's actually a thing that people are spending time on when, as we talk about often, there are some really serious, serious issues going on in the world right now. And people are spending their time with that. You have to look at other nations, I would think, and their leaders that are very much focused on gaining land, gaining world domination, Russia, etc. They must look at some of this stuff. I don't know if it ever passes their radar of what they're looking at, but if they see this, they have to shake their head. What's going on in that country?
Yeah, when one of the major topics of conversation is transracialism in America, you know that the country isn't going to stand up to in the realm of geopolitics, just because the reflection of the people's character is a reflection of how strong the nation can be outside its borders. And so just stories like this really show that the more turmoil inside of America, just the more Putin and China and Europe will have a longer leash to do what they want.
The next frontier is going to be transnationalism. You can't take over my country. I'm you. I identify as you.
I was already American before I came here. Yeah. I've been born American. I always was an American.
I wanted to dream. I was a dreamer.
Is it really any surprise, though, that over the last 8 years when the race card, the gender card, the poor card have been played like we've never seen, that we're also getting pushed around on the world scene in a way that we've never seen? It really is a parallel where we're so weak, we're so fragile here, and that does extend beyond our own borders.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're confused about your race, your gender, you know, you're worried about what you're going to say to not offend anybody, can you get together to even go have a battle somewhere? Of course not. So that's the state we're in today. And it's even interesting, last couple of days in Iran, their supreme leader came out and he had a couple of things against the U.S. And it's just stuff that we say. And he just picked it up like, it's the 1% holding all the wealth. I'm like, oh, really? Iran is the land of milk and honey? Yeah. How much money do you have? You know, come on. But they put it right back in our face because they pay attention to it. And that it is hurting us in a lot of ways. So pretty interesting stories. We'll have to cut it off there for today. Thanks for joining us on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau. We appreciate you being with us here on this Thursday. Have a great rest of your day. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.